KUCI.
It makes me wanna. KUCI.
It makes me wanna.
KUCI.
It makes me wanna.
KUCI.
It makes me wanna.
KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Well, good morning here at Get Notified, KUCI, Irvine, a radio show. We're here. We talk all about social media stuff. Whether you like social media, whether you hate it, whether you're completely confused by it, this is the show for you. Today, I'm excited because we are going to be learning about history. That is right. The way that social media affects history, the way that history is reflected in social media, and probably some lessons about George Washington and some other historical figures as well. But I'm not
wooden
sure.
Wooden teeth. I don't know.
Well, we have Ellen Bell here, who is actually a DJ at KUCI as well. Her show is Vintage Orange. And she is a history buff. Is that correct?
That is right.
Now, you do look strong, but I'm sure that mentally you have more information here for us than we can handle in an hour. But we're going to fit it into an hour.
Okay.
So give us the lowdown on yourself. And why are you so excited about history?
Well, you know, I think I've got to trace it back. I got to blame my dad because I grew up with a dad who was a history teacher. And so we spent all of our childhood vacation time traipsing around the Midwest in the family Truckster station wagon. Stopping.
Is that the name, the family Truckster wagon?
It kind of was, yeah. Nice. In our family it was. And yeah, we'd stop at every Civil War battlefield and historic marker on the road. And we weren't exactly the Griswolds, but kind of, you know, on that pattern. And he was just passionate about history. And his idea wasn't just to go and learn about it in books and things like that. Is he really wanted you to feel and sense and experience history firsthand. So we'd stop at a battlefield or a place, and he would tell us about where the troops were coming over the ridge and the smoke was rising, and he would make it come alive.
Yeah.
So I grew up thinking about history as not like a kind of a dead, boring thing in dusty museums, but something that was very vibrant and more of a story than anything else. So, you know, fast forward, I'm a mom, I've got kids, I'm going crazy in the house, and I just start doing these little field trips with my kids. But now I'm living here in Orange County, and I start taking them in the minivan all over the place, and we start learning and doing the same sort of thing, taking them to places where local history occurred, and then making it interesting, lively. Why did these things, not just, you know, okay, there's a mission there, but who were the people that lived inside? Why did they do the things that they did and experience it firsthand? So that kind of turned into this just passion for learning about local history. And about 4 years ago, I got involved. I wrote a book about Irvine history, got involved with the Irvine Historical Society because I live in Irvine, and started learning about the place that I have lived for almost 30 years and didn't really know. And I started seeing my hometown differently. I started, you know, looking at the hills differently. The roads meant different things because I knew why they were named what they were named. And it just enriched my experience of living here. So now what I love to do is to share that with other people and to get them excited about the history of their hometown, whether it be Irvine. Now I've expanded out to Orange County, really far. So what I do on Vintage Orange is we try and talk to people who are kind of the local experts, authors, pioneering residents of Orange County, and have them share their story and tell us a little bit more of the background. And then tie the pieces together so that people can go and visit it today, and they'll want to go out and explore and learn more about the place that they live.
Explore and learn more through the history, the living history, essentially.
Exactly, exactly.
And you're repeating the pattern that your father did as far as making this come alive.
Absolutely.
I was just listening to, I believe it was Kevin and Bean recently, and they had an author on. I don't know the name because I came in late to the show, but he is authoring these books called I Am Blank. So I am George Washington. I am Amelia Earhart.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an attempt to look at history from more of a realistic perspective that's story-based to connect with children.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at George Washington and you see him on the Potomac, if that's right. Even right, and it's everything is, wow, he's amazing. Like, how could he do anything wrong? And I could never be a president.
Right.
But when you find out that he was awkward as a kid, he didn't do good in school, he liked to dance, like all these things that created stories about real people. And then all of a sudden these children go, well, I'm kind of like that.
Yeah.
I'm not that good at math. That means maybe I could be the president. So it's an interesting look back at history. And where I think it's a fascinating subject is how social media has changed the way that we are documenting the history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're talking about real-time history and
yes.
things like Facebook that are catalysts to civil rights movements, let alone overthrowing governments, to this whole Turkey thing that just happened, where a president who is opinionated when it comes to social media yet uses FaceTime on national television to call people into the streets to fight for his presidency in a coup.
It's actually playing part in history. It's no longer, you know, journalism for the sake of reporting it. It's actively creating it, you know, and it's becoming part of the story instead of just observing the story. And social media is the way that it's because it is a personal, you know, everyone has access to it. It's global. It's immediate, which I think is probably, you know, I want to pick your brain about that, because that's the thing about social media that sometimes scares is a bad word. But, you know, is interesting to me about how there's this immediacy of it and how sometimes people can be immediate. I mean, we have presidential candidates tweeting, you know, and we've never had this before, you know, and the idea that you have world leaders and people like that that are going to be now kind of just reacting to things is a really interesting development, I think.
Oh, I'd love to get my brain picked. So we will get your picker out. And I mean, I believe that social media are tools. They're tools in itself, just like a microphone or an old school putting your hands over your mouth to reach further people in the back of the room.
Mm-hmm.
And the platforms themselves don't create any sort of success. It's the use of these different tools. And going back to historically a famous sort of, I guess, anecdote of mine is the question to Abraham Lincoln or some other wise man, you have a certain amount of hours to cut down a tree, what would you do? And you have two options. You have one where you sit there and hack at it for 4 to 5 hours. The other is where you sharpen it for 4 hours and then you spend 20 minutes cutting it down.
Mm-hmm.
So the tools themselves even have a sharpness to it. And you can have a very ineffective tweet that just goes nowhere in the world, is even misspelled, and then tagging the wrong people and put out into the world at a time where everyone's sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
So the tools themselves, it's interesting to see as they develop the different tactics that are used for these different toolboxes of politicians.
Mm-hmm.
And it can work against you, just like some celebrities that forget that they are speaking to the entire world.
Yes.
And the backlash is critical and crazy. Then you have these new platforms like Snapchat. They're doing a lot of interesting stuff with the news. Are you familiar with Snapchat at all?
Yes, okay. I snap.
You do? You're a snapper.
I am a snapper. I have like 3 friends, though. I only snap my kids. And and thankfully, they will allow me to see their Snapchat, which I think
exciting.
Is tremendous.
That is a circle of Snap Trust.
Snap Trust, exactly.
Have you played around with the news features or functions or stories?
I have kind of browsed around with that a little bit. Well, you know, again, I have to come at this old school. You know, I'm not, I love the innovation of social media, but I'm always a little suspect, and I'm thinking, what is being fed to me? You know, who's controlling and what, how's the content coming at me, and who's curating it? You know, what news stories
it's
are showing
ghost.
Up on
it
my...
It's a
little
white,
yellow...
It is a white, yellow ghost that wiggles around. They are controlling you.
Because I don't know the answer to that question, and I think I'm curious to know, is how do those stories appear on my screen? Who's deciding which ones are going to be there for my consumption that I have to see as an important thing to see?
Yeah, well, Snapchat is probably the most authentic platform when it comes to what is curated. Obviously, they have to make money, and there are people spending hundreds of millions of dollars to get in front of these viewers.
Mm-hmm.
But from a user-generated standpoint, Snapchat is one of the most authentic, because there is no algorithm that decides what you're going to see or not. It's if you're following someone, you see what they're posting, or you have the ability to. And even then, you've got to go in and dig into it. Recently, they have the scrolling stories where once you're done with one, it used to stop. Now it just sort of slams you into the next, and it takes you half a second to, is this that person? No. And then who's that person? And you can find out if that's engaging or not.
Right, right.
But again, Snapchat is just one tool out there. And here at Get Notified, we have this thing called the GTO. So the GTO is the grandma timeout. Okay? So if you were to describe Snapchat to your grandma from your own experiences, what would you describe Snapchat as?
It's a way to take pictures that disappear instantaneously. So it's just kind of a little glimpse of what somebody's doing without the fear of having it follow you forever and be perfect.
Right, right. I think grandma understands that. What are your social media platforms that you use personally other than Snapchat?
Well, I use, I guess I'd say I primarily use Facebook. That's probably the one that I, you know, that was my gateway drug to social media would be Facebook. I use Instagram quite a bit.
What do you think of the new Instagram stories?
I guess I'm not, remind me of that. Like,
okay,
the,
so you know Snapchat, right?
Yeah.
Literally, Instagram stole the entire function, feature, and functionality of Snapchat stories. So if you go, and it's this is not on the PC or your laptop when you look at your Instagram, you won't see it. But if you're on your phone and you have the newest app, up on the top you'll see these circles.
Oh, right, yeah.
And if you click on the circle, it's literally a Snapchat-esque story where you can show behind the scenes. It's a 10-second video. You have filters, but not the geo filters yet. You have lines that you can draw. You can have text. You can manipulate it. And it literally is almost the exact same core functionality as Snapchat.
Hmm.
And you almost have this uproar where these millennials are literally getting upset at Instagram for stealing the technology of Snapchat. So you have people going on Instagram that are putting stories to lead people back to their Snapchats or making fun of Snapchat on Instagram. And so there's kind of this feud. But what's nice about the stories, and I like the stories on Instagram because I already have a following on Instagram.
Right.
It's a little bit more transparent. You see who follows you. It's more of a above board. Snapchat, you have no idea really who's following you, who's not. It's a very elusive sort of platform. And sometimes the investment of putting together the stories and time and effort, you're not sure if it's going to yield results or an ROI or return on that time put in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the biggest challenges people have with social media is the time it takes or their misconception of the fact that it doesn't take time.
Well, you know, for every, I am a full disclosure person who's trying to get some sort of a brand out there, trying to let people know about local history and getting a website launched and all of this stuff. And the thing that overwhelms me, and I would imagine there are others like me, is this kind of, it appears to be so massive, you know, like, okay, I have to be doing this constantly. I've got to be, I have to have a Facebook post every day. I have to have Instagrams. I have to, and my Instagram page can only look like my brand. It can't look like a picture of my, you know, kid's birthday party. It's got to be, stick to the message. And there's, seems to be all these branding rules that at some point it just, it's like, where do you stop? And I'm coming to the point where it feels like you have to know exactly what you're trying to accomplish and then find the platform that matches that need. And because it seems virtually impossible to do all of it. But
I feel your pain and I've got some advice for you. I'm actually very much into branding. I've got a branding company. It's a 52-week course, runs you through a year program, step by step, all the things. And one thing you said, which is where does it stop?
Mm-hmm.
I would like to flip that and say, where does it start? And a lot of times people go into a branding exercise just blindly and they forget to figure out where they want to go.
Right.
So I've got a couple fun exercises for you that I'd be happy to share.
Okay.
That I suggest for people to do initially. This is part of the course that I have and I've done this hundreds of times. It's a really fun exercise too. And it has to do with post-it notes. Do you like post-it notes?
I do.
Well, the trick is you get two different colors of post-it notes. I think like maybe a blue or a pink and then the classic yellow because it's not as intimidating. And what you do is you go around to people that you know very well, that you sort of know and that you are acquaintances with, and maybe even some people that you know but you don't really know, but they know you, maybe some other DJs or something. And the trick is that you go to these people and you ask them, you say, can you write down 1, 3, 5, 10, however many you have, words or phrases of what you think about me when somebody mentions my name? Like, what do you think of when you think about me? And what you also do is, before you start collecting them, this is all anonymous, by the way, right?
Yeah.
What you do is you tell them, you don't look at what they tell you first, and you go to your post-it notes, and you write down all the things that you want to be seen as. This brand represents what, or it's this, or
what
it's that.
What you think your goal is for it, yeah.
And here's where the magic happens, is that I talk about this being your vision, and the first part of your brand being your vision. Most people think, well, this is what I want to be seen and in the world. And you even had these, I want to be seen as this historical thing. Mm-hmm. I want to be known as an authority figure, maybe. I want to find people to think that I'm inquisitive, but I'm also accepting, and all these different elements. But the easiest way to convince somebody to think of something is to just reinforce what they already think. So I always say that the vision for your personal brand or your company brand is the intersection between what people already think about you and what you want to be seen as. That's where you start. So you get all these post-it notes. Here's the exercise. You have yours filled out ahead of time, and you get all these people to return them. Let's say you get 10 people and they do 5 each. You have 50 post-it notes. You put them up on the wall just in one big scattered, no order. And then you start to group them. And you'll see that people tend to group, you know, you'll find that the feedback groups into certain sections. Then you take your post-it notes and you put them into the sections that match.
Mm-hmm.
Some sections will not have your post-it notes in it. Some comments will shock you. You'll be like, well, I didn't think I was that aggressive, but maybe I am to some people. Then you take the 3 circles that have your post-it notes and other people's post-it notes, and that's what forms what I call your branding starship. And it's a 3-pronged starship. And I believe that 3 is the magic number, and this is how we count. 1, 2, 3, right. Many, right? Spanish, 1, 2, 3, mucho. French, 1, 2, 3, buco. Just don't go past 3, no matter what. If you're speaking or if you have a presentation, focus on 3. Because people forget after that.
Yep.
What you can do is you can find what everybody else thinks about you, intersect it with where what you want to be thought about, and then in the world, you can go out there and say, hey, I am this, this, and this. And they're going to go, well, yeah. Yeah, you're...
That fits.
Yep, that's it. I see you there. And with this branding starship, you literally have sort of... Think of 3 engines, right? And then you have to next choose your destination. What is this sort of mothership that you're going towards? What is this planet in the ether? And until you find out what that is, you shouldn't even leave the ground. The idea is that if you don't have a starship, you're literally spinning around in space. You might have a picture of a kid's party. You might have this. You might have your website. You might want to promote something coming in the future. But if you know these are the 3 core elements of my brand and this is where I want to go, then you can literally evaluate each social media as, I call them, asteroids. It's either a safe place to land and refuel or recharge, and it works, or it's something that literally you're going to crash into and have to repair yourself from. Because it's not about being on all platforms. It's about being on right platforms.
Yes.
But what right platforms is where you want to go, and then it really digs into a market exercise, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between a target market and a market potential?
Well, a target market would just be what you are wanting to achieve, or where you think maybe you want to go, and then the market potential is what's actually there.
Okay.
I don't know.
There's elements of that, definitely. But I like to think of the target market as, say, the first 100 people who are going to sign up for your email and list, or that are going to be on your show, or that are going to be your listeners, those hyper-focused, narrowed-down group of people that are going to appreciate your brand, are going to want to engage with your brand, they're going to be your early customers and adopters.
Okay.
But if you think about it, well, there's millions of people in Orange County, and this thing could go viral, and everybody could love it, and it could be, you know, we could create maps, and then they could go and, like, living history in it, and you start to get out there, and you go... Yeah. This could be for everyone or anyone. I like to encourage people not to swear, especially the A word and the E word, and that is anyone or everyone. As soon as you think your brand is for anyone or everyone, that's a red flag. Somebody should put soap in your mouth. So if you focus on this target market, then are they on Instagram? Are they on Facebook? Are they on Pinterest?
Right.
Where are they? And then you can start catering a singular message built around three sort of guiding principles of your starship. And then the one thing I always tell people is that there is no easy solution to social media strategy. And there are a number of things that might work for you, might work for someone else, and not work for somebody else. But the only thing that will keep you successful when it comes to any social media platform is consistency.
Yes, and that is a problem.
That's it. So you were saying I have to have a Facebook post every day. I would rather have you do one every week.
Right.
But every single week, that's
exactly it. Exactly.
Gary Vaynerchuk, I love him. He's aggressive and he's a loud mouth and he swears a lot. And he tells it like he thinks it is. One of the things he talks about is who cares who's following you. He suggests you shouldn't even give two bleeps about your followers until like 3 years down the line. And if you think about that, how many people are conscious about their followers from day one?
Mm-hmm.
It's literally this idea. If you know where you're going and you're going to go, Jerry Maguire, grab your fish and be like, who's coming with me? If you're not coming with me, I'm still going that direction. So I see a lot of social media campaigns start and then stop. Or people jump on a Facebook and then stop.
Because they're response driven rather than content driven, and they kind of aren't, they've lost their focus. And
yeah.
So what you're saying is that it's actually more important to, you know, create your content, create your message. It's go out there and do what you want to do.
Know what you want to do,
right.
And then create your messaging around it. So for me, it's communication. I'm a total communication geek.
Mm-hmm.
And my asteroid out there in the far ether that I'm everything works towards is this 313 concept, where I literally take any business, any personal brand, anybody, and I believe I help them solve the biggest problem that they have. It's a big bloody problem. It's their inability to explain what they do or who they are in a very short amount of time.
The old elevator pitch.
Yeah, but I'm trying to get rid of the elevator pitch. Right? I'm trying to eliminate it, because the elevator pitch is disingenuous and inauthentic because it's rehearsed and it's trying to fit within a certain period of time, and it's anybody who gives you that sort of elevator pitch,
mm-hmm.
you know that it's their elevator pitch. The concept of communicating in a short amount of time, I'm very passionate about, and I've created this 313 concept, which is a theory and an exercise, and it helps you explain your business in three sentences, and then one sentence, and then three words. And it really gets to the core communication of what it is that you're doing. And I like to say, the more you talk, the less people listen.
Mm-hmm.
And the less you talk, the more people will ask questions. And it's really questions that drives conversation. And nobody wants to be told anything, because we've all had parents. People want to find out for themselves. They want to learn. They want to engage in conversation. So as soon as you spit your elevator pitch into somebody's face, you're doing yourself and them an injustice, because you're missing the communication part. For me, it's about helping people to effectively communicate more.
Well, I've heard this a lot too, when people try and describe social media more as a conversation rather than a one-sided sales, like, okay, here's everything that I'm doing, blah, blah, blah. Just this explosion of content, as opposed to, I think what I'm hearing for you is to have more of a focus on your purpose and your mission, and more of an internal focus before you even get out there and be external. Why are you even doing this in the first place? And stay really clear to that, so that when you, everything that you engage with out there, and it is engaging, it's not just a one-sided blast or expression. It's a conversation. It's why am I saying this in the first place? Why do I want you to talk to me? And what are you saying in response? And, kind of understanding that the fact this is a two-way, I don't know, conversational medium.
You can have a marketer get you in front of thousands of people, right? And you can get a post that you boost and get in front of 14,000 people for only $29.95 on Facebook. But the engagement oftentimes is not there, or
right.
It's this very spammy
it's
space.
It's not authentic.
It's not authentic.
Mm-hmm.
If you took the time to direct message 1,000 people, you wouldn't know what to do with yourself, because you'd have so much interaction and engagement. But there's the problem. You're investing more time in less relationships. And that's why it's so important to find the right people. I'm working on this article right now with a buddy about how sending annoying, spammy messages is like ruining your relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And are you on Twitter at all?
Mm-hmm.
When you follow people, 9 times out of 10, there's an automatic message response from a robot, right?
Right.
And it literally says, hey,
thanks for the follow.
Thanks for the follow. Check out my blog, or thanks for the follow. Follow me on Facebook, or hey, I realize this is a robot, but, okay? So that's so disingenuous. It doesn't do anything. Oftentimes, I'll write back and I'll be like, do you really expect me to respond to a robo answer? And then they'll be like, oh, no, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Or I'll respond to somebody and then they don't respond. I'll say, no, this is not an auto response.
I'm actually here.
I'm actually a person. And it's amazing the conversation that you can spark on a very one-to-one level and build very fast relationships, meet them in person, build your network. But it's counterintuitive because it's like, it's only one person. So going back to this target market, you could look through thousands of people on Twitter or LinkedIn or whatever and directly message with them, and it'd be way better effective use of your time than to update a post on Facebook every day that's getting a lot of views but no engagement.
Well, that's one of the things that I think is one of the best parts about social media, is the fact that you can be so efficient with your message. And for instance, when I've been doing research for a book or a project or whatever, and I want to get information from people, so I was doing a piece about Irvine in the early 70s, and so how do I get a hold of people who are in Irvine in the early 70s? I went on a Facebook group that was I Grew Up in Irvine, and I put a post on there that said, hey, who went to this high school, and do you remember this? I was inundated with all these people who wanted to talk about their high school, because I had found the actual perfect market, the audience. I'd been able to pinpoint them directly because I used Facebook. I didn't just go to my random Facebook friends and say, hey, I'm doing an article about this. I went right to, it allowed me to bring that universe down to a smaller pool. And then I got really great results, and people who were interested in what I was doing, they didn't feel like they were being bothered or pestered or anything. They wanted to talk about their high school memories, and it was a perfect match. It was definitely a win-win. So I love that about Facebook and other social media, that you're able to kind of cater what you want to accomplish and get it to the right audience.
But how niche was that group?
What do you mean?
Like growing up in Irvine.
It was, yeah.
So again, it's the more niche you can go, or
yeah.
niche, people still think that more is better. And I really argue that, less is
a lot of times more. It's more efficient. Yeah, I think you want to get to the point where you are spotlighting or getting to that audience that really wants your message. And because it is kind of like beating your head against the wall if you're just going to be throwing stuff, content out there, and not really knowing who, not just what your purpose is, but who's going to be interested in this in the first place. But it's interesting. I think one branding is one thing, but social media, as we all know, is part of everyday life in this country. A lot of people are not interested in a brand, or they're not opening a business. They just want to stay in touch with their friends. They just like, it's become a pastime. It's become an obsession.
It's the history of what happened yesterday. It's the history of what happened earlier in the week. It's kind of a living documentary of what's going on with people's friends and things
right,
like that.
Right, which is fascinating, because then there would be those people that say, well, is it really history, or is it just what you're presenting to be your history? The joke about, the Facebook, we all are striving to live the lives that we show on Facebook.
Right.
That obviously people aren't putting out there their difficult things, or some people are, and you kind of wish they didn't, but but it's generally your lovely scrubbed life. And I'm the same way. I'm not going to put a picture on Facebook that I don't like a picture of myself. So we're all curating our lives.
Now, don't you think that's happened in the past? And I'm not going to talk about like a big ancient book, but for relative history's sake, how much is picked and chosen of what makes the history books, what doesn't? And even in our recent past, you've got major events that are somehow left out of the, the educational institution, and they sort of are overlooked. And, culturally, we've been scrubbing information that we've been fed and feeding people for a long time.
Well, history is unfortunate. Well, that's a biased word, unfortunately. But history is vulnerable, I think, to interpretation. And I think this media The fact that we can communicate so rapidly and sometimes without thought behind it.
Yes.
That sometimes things evolve and the stories get tweaked and twerked and changed
around.
Right,
it's an operator game, right? Where I tell somebody and they tell somebody, yeah. Especially like living oral histories of things,
exactly.
Change very quickly.
And, you know, there was some of this back in the day before media and all the technology caught up to it, where, you know, you'd have a story that went from rumors would get passed from the Pony Express and all of this and through media accounts, and people were getting their news stories that were very biased and one-sided and rumors and all of this.
I mean, even a literacy level probably had a lot to do with that as well, right?
Sure. I mean, there always has been some element of storytelling with our history. But the thing that I find really interesting right now is what people are willing to accept as fact. Because they see it on,
well, if it's on the internet,
a
it's
Twitter
true.
Feed.
It's
yeah.
true if it's on the internet.
And this this kind of frankly terrifies me a bit, because I don't see the fact checking. I don't see the sourcing. I don't see, you know, journalism now. You have so many excellent journalists that are losing their jobs because the media industry is changing and being replaced by content providers that are cutting and pasting and sourcing and not really doing the work themselves. And so a lot of what we see as being historical fact or reported, it's a bit sketchy at times. And that makes me a little bit nervous, frankly. I mean, I'll tell you an example. At the Historical Society, the Irvine Historical Society, we get approached quite often by businesses that are wanting to get pictures of Irvine for their bank lobby or their new hotel they're opening, and they want to have a picture of Irvine in it. And, you know, so they'll send me an email with some pictures that they found. We found these pictures of Irvine. Well, they're not of Irvine. They found them. They Googled something. They Googled images. So one of them was Irvine in Scotland. And I'm like, this is not even here.
Right.
You know, but they were ready to put that on the wall in their business and say, this is Irvine. Or they'd have the dates completely wrong. And you know, it's because they copied and pasted a story that was copy and pasted, and nobody really had, you know, we'd gotten too far away from the truth. And that scares me a little bit, because I don't know if it just moves so fast or people rely on, they just have confidence in Wikipedia.
Or they grew up as it being the authority, right? You used to look up something in the dictionary,
right.
Now you just Google it.
Yeah.
I mean, the Googling phenomenon. I got in a fight with Google the other day trying to come up with an answer, and one of my guests was Googling it and reading it, and I was like, it was a hashtag Google fight. So
of course
it is an interesting point, and perception is reality to some extent. So
yeah.
Whether somebody sees a landscape that they thought was Irvine and it's not, to them, maybe even chemically, it's like giving them the same warm fuzzy feelings. But you're right, there's a total
it's
facade
not the truth.
Behind it.
And I guess, okay, truth can be, there's some level of relevance, you know, truth is what you make of it and what you see in perception. But there has to be, the further away we get from it, there has to be that foundation in the real fact, you know, that really happened. And yes, you can have interpretations about whether it was a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, we can debate that. And I think that's why we're human beings with our own brains and our own perceptions. But we can't debate that it happened at this date and this fact and this, you know, that we have to have something that we agree on. And that I feel really passionate about, making sure we get the facts straight.
Yeah. Now, a very analogous point about authenticity when it comes to images and facts is following.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about this concept of, you know, who cares about your following, but intrinsically you do care about your following because you're using that as constant reassurance. But as of the recent couple years, you can buy your following.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But you can also verify that. Here's a fun tip for somebody who sees someone on Twitter and they're like, oh, this guy has, you know, I was going to bring up Joe Paluzzi, and I'll talk about him in a minute. Content
mm-hmm.
Inc. Have you heard of him?
Mm-mm.
Brilliant guy. So here's an example of Joe Paluzzi, and he's saying he's got 184,347 followers. Okay? That's impressive. That's a lot
yeah.
of people. I like it. But if you go to Twitter, auditaudit.com, I think. Twitteraudit.com. You literally can go in there and verify, right? So let's see. I've got to first look at Joe's. I got to click here.
Do they have names and addresses and birthdays? And
okay,
what kind of verifying are we talking about?
Well, let's see. Well, check it out. So CMI content, that's Joe Paluzzi's content marketing. So okay. I go over here to Twitter audit, and I type in the screen name, and I audit, and survey says 93% audit score of the 180-some-odd thousand. There is 176,069 real people. However, he has 13,456 people who are fake.
And how so are they fake? Are these people that are just doing this, or are they, the, like you said, are they
A lot of times it's not something that he's buying, but there's a lot of auto generation and machines and bots and things that are out there that are following to create an interaction that then creates a follow back. And there's thousands of those out there. There's different, that's one of the most effective types of strategies for growth hacking on Twitter and on other forums. It's called a follow back strategy. Have you heard of that?
Well, I imagine so, yeah.
So what happens when somebody follows you? What do you do psychologically?
I guess you'd want to follow. It's polite.
But you
right?
don't necessarily, you don't, you might want to check them
well,
out.
Well, it doesn't, yeah, if I don't know who like, they are.
Right, you're curious, right? So you click on them.
Or if I think they're just selling something that's kind of random. But yes, I would.
So
I would
let's
see
say
who
if,
this person is.
Yeah, you see
you
who they
click
are.
On them.
And then if the image maybe resonates, and you might judge them by the amount of followers that they have, and then you see if their bio looks scary or creepy, and then if their background header is like, interesting, and then
or if I have something in common,
yeah,
with
you might
business.
Read the bio and then whoa, this guy is a speaker doing this, or he's also a historian. This is really cool. You scroll, you might see one of the first three tweets, and the first tweet is probably pinned. It's got a lot of likes and retweets. You're like, that's cool. This guy, I like him back. And there's actually follow back ratios. You know, for X amount of people you follow, based on how your profile looks and how it's set up, you can increase that follow back rate. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm not saying anything bad about Joe Paluzzi. Joe, I love you, man. I'm here to give you some props. But even a very high in-demand, predominant, speaks around the world on content marketing, he's got, you know, he's off by 10 or 13 grand of real people. So the point is you have to kind of go into social media knowing with a bit of a caveat, right? Don't believe everything you see.
Mm-hmm.
But there are tools to check and verify. And a lot of times you can just sniff it out. If you have somebody with, you know, thousands of followers, but no engagement, nobody likes any of the tweets, it could be disingenuous.
So, yeah, I think I see two different levels here. I see the person who wants to use social media for business and for to be able to increase the audience for a brand or to help generate more income, branding, partnerships, all of that.
Yes.
And then I also see people who are just using it for their own
using and consuming
socially,
and enjoying.
Yeah. And so for them, I don't see necessarily the need, the follower increasing. I mean, maybe it's an ego thing that everybody wants to have so many followers, but I guess I'm just really curious about it as a social statement about where the times that we live in, about the need for people to document their lives. And I'm not saying this as an outside observer, by the way, by any chance. I mean, I'm guilty as charged. But what is it that makes us all our own historians today? Why do we feel that, you know, we have to be documenting things? Why do we have to be taking pictures of ourselves? Why do we have to be? And if we don't, we somehow feel like we're not involved or plugged in somehow.
It's a sense of keeping up with the Joneses to some
yeah.
extent.
I mean, it's kind of wild, isn't it? I mean, I can't remember another time when we felt so compelled to share so much about our personal lives, and yet we aren't really sharing it personally. We're not really telling. We're not all in a room together sharing these things. It's kind of like this anonymous sharing.
Yeah. Hey, look at me. And then within 3 minutes, it's bombarded by a bunch of others.
Yeah.
And then you get some of these rock star celebrities that have so much influence over so many people just based on this sharing. And that kind of goes to this crazy brand washing and marketing component, product placement, influencer marketing.
Yeah.
Literally, I think Kim Kardashian charges like $500,000 to put one tweet with your product. but people see a return on it because all of a sudden now it's cool. And it's it really gets more to, I think, of a sociological experiment mixed with history. I mean, history, it's like a living history, but it's really a sociological mixed with psychological, because you have young kids that are now straight up first toy is an iPad and they are super proficient. And it's like, that's what they grew up with. I grew up where I spent my summers in Catalina and played with rocks and like pretended to have stuff. So I come from a unique, very analog, got a pager in high school and then the first flip phones and then it turned to a cell phone, then smartphone, then laptop, then iPad. And like, I've seen that transition.
Right.
But people coming in now, people that are born today, they're going to get the iPhone 7 and the 8 and the 9.
And I look at, you know, my niece and nephew, and then I have, you know, they're having children, and I see these kids are constantly on camera. I swear they're going to grow up feeling like an iPhone is supposed to be flashing in their face.
Yeah.
Or else what if not, what's wrong? Why isn't anybody taking my picture?
Yeah.
Because they are constant, their whole life's being documented. And I mean, I love it because I love seeing these pictures, and I think there's a wonderful way that we can all stay connected. I mean, the positive part about social media is that the world has gotten smaller with people that we love. And, you know, my sisters live across the country and I can still see them and see what they're doing. And I love that. I like being connected in that way. I like having friends that I can be connected with that maybe I would have lost touch with years ago. And it's nice to be able to have those connections still. But I don't know. It's just...
Well, here's the thing. History determines the future. So you get to tell us what's going to happen then. Based on the history, historically speaking, has there been any other revolution technologically that we can make an analogy to about bringing people closer together? And how is it just so far off the mark? We don't even have a historical reference
right
now.
I think the interesting thing, and I am by far can't speak to all of this, but what it feels like to me is that there's been nothing that has reached the speed of this. And sure, you can talk about the Industrial Revolution changed things dramatically when people moved to the cities and socially everything changed in that way and people were much closer together and all of that. You had some speed and things like that. But I don't think you can compare anything. I mean, I suppose with media, the advent of television and telephone, things that happened. I mean, the things that happened in my grandmother's lifetime. With before telephones to up through space launches and things like that and into early computers and internet. It's amazing to me the shift that happened so quickly.
How important is this, is understanding where grandma was and life before phones? How important is the documenting of that history, the understanding of that history, and it being accurate to sort of what's going on? Because I don't know, I mean, this is your challenge, right? How do you get people in Irvine to be concerned or care about what happened, you know, 100, 200 years ago? And are you finding that they actually care? Is there going to be a revolution to sort of go back to the anti-phone?
Well, I have actually seen people wanting to get back to a simpler way of looking at things. And we've had a lot more interest of just recently in the last few years, even of people coming into Irvine, into our historical society, because the city is around, it's been around, you know, close to 50 years now. There have been people living here for
UCI
50
years. Is officially 50.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
And so you're getting to an age where they can now see it as historic. You know, there's something, it's not all brand spanking new. And there is a generations now that are kind of like, well, what was here before? And there is, people are having a hunger, I think, to know about what life was in a slower, simpler time.
Well, let's whet the appetite for people. What are some interesting facts? I have one question. I don't want to put you on the spot, but there was a recent, and I don't know if this is the book that you were involved with, but it was the origins of Orange County. And it was this huge book that basically documented almost the entire history of Irvine with all the leaders, and they all came to the Beckman Center. It was this big hoopla. Everybody was there. It's like a who's who of Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
And the gentleman who presented it, who wrote it, he's like got 7 different degrees. He is super well known, a huge philanthropist to UCI. And in his original speech, he was talking 2 things that caught my ear, and it was very interesting. One was the root of why Orange County is not Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
and two, that Orange County was named Orange County before there were even oranges.
That is absolutely true.
I want to know about the second first and the first second. So oranges, we were named Orange County. I think most people think it's because we have orange groves.
Well, of course. I mean, isn't that a logical thought? I mean,
yes,
of course
just
would...
like the picture that I thought was from Irvine was actually
from Scotland.
Scotland,
yeah.
You know?
No, it was a marketing ploy. And because at that time when they were deciding, they were, you know, Orange County finally becomes its own county and they're trying to decide what to name it. And, you know, you had Anaheim originally wanted to have it named after them because they were the first city here, first settlement. But at the time, they were trying to get people to come out here and settle. And the idea of oranges had this very exotic Mediterranean look. People were looking for a place for health reasons. Some of them wanted to find a place that drier climate, the sunshine. And so they thought, okay, let's call it Orange County. Because
so it's just a straight up
marketing.
Straight up marketing.
And then eventually it came true. Yeah, but they did not, there weren't massive orange propagation here when they named it Orange County. That's
so that's
true.
That's very analogous to somebody being deceitful on a tweet, maybe about going to a certain party or a certain event, like building up to be people that maybe aren't there, and then people show up, and then it's like, but I guess the speed at which people found out or they show up, they're like, oh, maybe there's oranges couple miles away or something like that.
Oh, well, there's a lot of stuff happening, a lot of promises being made in the late 1800s here that were real estate ploys and trying to get people to use the train to come out here and luring people to buy land. And so, you know, it's funny. I mean, there was a big real estate boom in the late 1880s here. And just like in, you know, 2008, we kind of had some bubbles. This has happened before in Orange County. And, you know, that's an interesting part about history, too, is that if you don't really understand, it has similar things have happened before. And if we can't understand what is it, who's the person that I'm supposed to name this quote for? If we can't understand the history, we're doomed to repeat it.
What I think is interesting is not only what history says, but what people think. Right?
Mm-hmm.
What people think, and I'm actually taking on a pretty exciting large-scale project. Are you familiar with the TEDx?
Mm-hmm.
TED and TEDx?
Yeah.
So TEDx LA is coming up December 3rd and 2nd and 3rd, and I made a proposal not for a speech, but for a city experiment. And it got accepted, and I call it the City of Speakers. Hmm. And it's my attempt at capturing the voice of Los Angeles. And what I'm doing is I'm collecting at a minimum 100, and I'm already well on my way. We launched about 5 or 6 days ago, just September 1st. And the concept is to find a cross-section of Los Angeles that's like a universal voice. And it doesn't even have to make sense. It's going to be like an art project where the paint are people's voices. So I'm not looking for facts. I'm looking for whatever facts are in somebody's head. What is your vision? What's going on in the world? What's happening with you? And then I'm going to take all these audio clips, pictures, drawings, video, whatever it is. I'm somehow going to mesh it together, document the process, and see if I can spit something out that says, this is the current voice or this is the voice of Los Angeles.
Where are you culling it from? Where are you getting all of your material from? Where's the content come from?
So the content is going to be from interviewing thousands of people.
So literally you're going to do face-to-face interviews.
Face-to-face.
This is not a social media
No,
thing.
A social media leveraging as well, right?
Okay.
If you go to cityofspeakers.com, you can submit your voice. I've got people that are creating like a street team to go out into downtown Los Angeles
okay.
and document, record from people. I have large events that I'm piggybacking off of that I get 10 minutes and I explain it and then I have people give me their voice at that point.
Okay.
I was in an event where I passed out blank thank you cards and people drew what their voices were and then had other people reenact them. So the idea is to just collect as many as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting spin on sort of whatever reality is now because it is sort of in the eye of whoever's speaking their voice at that time. And I think that people's voice is the most powerful thing they have. But the challenge is a lot of people don't feel like they have a voice or
it's not important.
Mm-hmm. And we size people up all the time and we go, well, who cares what that person thinks because they're that or they're this or mm-hmm. that. So it's kind of an effort to just go through the process and learn and be humbled by the just hundreds of thousands of different experiences that people are facing and what their voice is and then smash it all in together and it probably is not going to make any sense, and that's what's exciting about it, because it'll take its own form.
Because you don't know where you're going to end up at the end of it. That is wonderful.
It's kind of like the anti-history, where I'm not basing this in any fact or reality. It's sort of whatever this weird world has created, like what does it mean to us right now?
I actually think that's more historic, is actually capturing the authentic pulse of people rather than having it fed to you in a Twitter feed, you know, but actually to go out there and talk to people as individuals. That is one other thing that I feel in this massive media discussion that we all live in constantly 24 hours a day, that we sometimes lose this sense that we're actually talking to individual people. It seems like this big monolith, huge discussion, and you know, one wave of opinion will sway, and what, you know, it's all these giant.
Yeah, it's trending or it's not, or it's here and
polling or whatever. And I think sometimes if we lose track of the fact that if you just take five people in a room and you say, okay, what do you think about this? And what do you think? And I'm not going to tell you if you're right or just what do you think about this?
Yeah.
And can look at people. I think we've lost the humanness of these discussions, that we've lost our ability to see people as individuals, and instead of as a demographic or a political party or a age group or a race, that we aren't just looking at people as humans with which we share so many needs and wants and drives that are common. I think there's so much more common in people than there are disparate between us. And right now, everybody just sees the differences in what's not them. And I think if people could get to something like your project where they are able to just, okay, what do you think? And what do you think? Depending on, regardless of.
Yeah, we're not looking for right answers, because
there is no right answer. And that we would be able to look at people and go, you know what? I don't agree with you, but I see why you feel that way, because you're human. You know, this is what brought you.
And a mom
this
from
opinion.
Compton is going to have a different perspective than somebody from Newport, or from somebody who's a CEO, or somebody who's a struggling busboy.
So when you look at history from a perspective as it was made by human beings, it was experienced by human beings, that's when you can really get to the baseline of why did things happen? You know, why did certain leaders come to power? Why did certain wars happen? Why did certain governments rise and fall? That there were very human people. Like, you got back to the beginning of talking about I am George Washington, or I am a character.
Yeah, you're right.
These were living, breathing people that experienced these things. They weren't just pictures in a gallery or names in a book. And if we can get back to feeling like not only the people before us were human, but the people we're living with now are human, then maybe we can actually learn from each other and move forward in a way that's productive and not just a bunch of noise.
I love it, because social media can feel like a lot of noise, but we are humans behind the computers.
Yeah.
The real ones, at least. And it's interesting, because it is literally reflecting constantly of what's happening, and tomorrow it will become history to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you want to submit your voice, I would love to hear it.
I would love that. Yeah.
Go to cityofspeakers.com, and I'm always looking for people to join the team. We're literally only into about a week or two into it right now.
That's
so,
a very exciting project.
And
I
from
really
a historian
like
standpoint, I'd love, you know, advice on how. For me, I like things structured, except for radio shows, because they just go all over the place, and I love that. But what's exciting for me is that I don't know how it's going to take shape, and the project will shape itself.
Yeah, but isn't that cool?
It's so exciting.
Yeah.
And then we're going to present sort of the documentary on stage in front of 3,500 people. And the unique thing about it is, instead of like a TED Talk where you're saying, this is my idea, and then it's done, we're going to run for 3 months, and then we're going to say, this is what we found out. We want to continue, I'd like to continue this for years, collect hundreds of thousands of voices, document them, and then just like smash them into an art project together.
Oh, I think it's fabulous. I mean, that's another big reason why I wanted to do the Vintage Orange show, is I was having conversations with people who were, in their upper 80s, and I thought, I get to have this conversation with this personal, first person pioneer person who was there when it happened.
Yeah, makes it real. It's their
voice. How many
voice?
People
yeah.
get to do that? I mean, not a lot of people get to do that. You read a newspaper or a quote, maybe you read it in a book or something, but I actually get to be in the room with them as I'm gathering this research, and I thought, that's a shame. So that's a lot of what the show is that I do, is it. I podcast them. I talk with people, and I want to preserve their voices.
And when is your show so people can find you? Because we've been having so much fun, we're all out of time, which is a shame. But you're on, and people can get more of you. Tell us about your show. How
I'm
we find
on.
You.
I'm on every Wednesday at 4 o'clock, KUCI Vintage Orange, and I'm on for just a half hour. Goes by quickly, but every week we just have a different topic about Orange County history, and from people who know it best, the local people who live it and have taught about it and learned about it and written about it, and I learn something every week.
Very cool. Well, I learned some stuff today, and hope you did too. All of you out there that now are going to second guess before you hit the send button, because every single tweet, every single Snapchat, every single thing you do is creating the history of
it
the
has
future.
Meaning, exactly.
It has meaning.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yes. Well, I'd love to hear your voice again, and we'll do coffee and we'll see how we can collect other voices, get people excited about the history of Orange County. And ladies and gentlemen, Orange County did not start with oranges,
but we
have plenty of them now, and that should be a lesson to you. If there's not something there, grow it. Don't forget to say hi to your grandma for me, and we will see you soon. This is Ryan with Get Notified. Find me at Ryan Foland. And tweet me up. Ginger jokes are cool, but no cyberbullying. Be nice to people. Bye, Grandma. We're out.
Thanks for listening to Get Notified. To catch more shows, go to getnotified.kci.org. And to be a guest on the show, you can submit an application online, too. This is Angie, signing off.